I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Andrea Warner joins me now, the music journalist and arts writer, who is an associate producer over at CBC Music and a freelance contributor to Exclaim and the Georgia Street, has written a wonderful book, We Oughta Know, How Four Women Ruled the 90s and Changed Canadian Music. Between 1993 and 1997, Celine Dion, Sarah McLachlan, Alanis Morissette, and Shania Twain became some of the best-selling artists in Canadian music. In fact, of the 10 best-selling artists in Canada, five are Canadian, four of whom I've just mentioned. These mid-1990s years coincided with Ms. Warner's formative years. She had strident views on these artists. She remains an Alanis fan and found solace in Sarah McLachlan's music. On Celine Dion and Shania Twain, however, she was a little less of a fan. She explains why and how she's reevaluated these talented women and their impact not only on music but on her. It's a compelling book, especially when Andrea works through those awful years when we're growing up. It's part memoir as well as a marvelous sketch of popular culture with insightful music criticism. The website for more is at theandreawarner.com. The book is published by Eternal Cavalier. Please welcome to the Plant Online program in person today, Andrea Warner. Ms. Warner, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you.
Thanks for coming in to do this. I appreciate it.
Oh, I appreciate it so much.
So you work at CBC Music. What exactly is your job there?
I'm an associate producer, and I write about music.
And you've also served on the Polaris jury?
Yeah, I've been on the Polaris jury for a couple of years now. I was on the grand jury, actually, in my first year, which was a really cool and weird experience because I had only just started contributing, and suddenly I was in Toronto in the room deliberating.
And I hear there's an opening on the jury.
Apparently a few. Who knew?
Yeah,
who knew?
So for people that are listening to this that probably haven't read the book, and I'm assuming that a lot of them haven't, but they ought to because, it's as I said in the introduction, it's such a compelling read. I enjoyed it a great deal. I guess, to be perfectly frank, I enjoyed it more than I expected to because these women are not people that I have on my iPod.
Yeah, fair enough. I kind of hope to surprise people.
In terms of your life thus far, because you write in the book quite candidly about growing up in this town and what you like to listen to. A couple of these women you liked, a couple of them you didn't like. It seems a perfect fit that you work at CBC Music now.
I mean, it's kind of fortuitous, actually. I did not think necessarily that I would end up here.
Yeah.
I have always written. I started a magazine when I got out of journalism school when I was 21. That was arts and pop culture and things like that. It sort of failed spectacularly in the way that stuff does when you're 21 and 22. 'Cause I didn't really know about magazines and advertising. I had just gone to journalism school, and I didn't want to work in politics or move to a small town and write about life there. I always wanted to write about the arts, and I was sort of told that's not possible. So I thought, screw it, I'm going to do it myself. And so I did for a couple of years, and then I took some time off to work in, I don't know, the usual sort of mid-20s jobs that you might work at, like managing call centers and things like that. But I always kept starting publications and creative projects when I was there. And finally, one day, I was just like, this is stupid. You just want to write, so just go do that.
So was this the goal then, to find a job writing and then have it be about music?
No, actually, I wanted to write about film. Uh-huh. When I quit my job with the goal of freelancing, my plan was to write movie reviews. And so I went and reviewed a movie in Seattle that wasn't coming out for a long time, the rest of the country, in Canada, and actually was getting a longer delayed release in North America. I wrote the review. I sent it out to 70 publications around North America. The West Ender and the Charleston City Paper in South Carolina are the ones that got back to me, and they hired me to start doing film reviews. And one day, about a month after I started with Charleston, I noticed that Art Garfunkel was going to be there, and I thought it would be so weird and interesting and awesome to interview him. I had always loved music so much, and I did a lot of it, you know, with my magazine, but it had been a number of years, and so I just pitched them on this idea, and they're like, if you can get him, do it, because he doesn't say yes to a lot of stuff. And so I did, and it was amazing, and I actually quit writing about film for Charleston and started writing just about music, and then that's sort of how my freelance career shaped up.
So you talked to him mainly about music or mainly about film?
Art Garfunkel?
Yeah.
Music.
Music, yeah. Because he has had a film career that, it didn't really take off, but he's made a couple films that
I just, the film editor and I didn't really see eye to eye that well. Yeah. And the music editor and I got on brilliantly, so I ended up being a music contributor in Charleston for 5 years, and then I got hired on at the West Ender to do listings as their editor, listings editor, and then when their music editor left, I took on the music as well.
When you work in music,
yes,
as a critic, as a journalist, does that change how you listen to music? I mean, you grew up listening to music as a fan. We all do.
Yeah.
Now that it's your job, is that altogether different?
It is actually really different. I'm such a person who focuses on the lyrics, and I'm always, when I listen to music, my brain goes into this place where I'm actually thinking up stories all the time, or I'm thinking sort of critically about the music. I mean, I'm enjoying it. I can listen to it passively if I tell my brain to do that. But for the most part, I'm listening to it all day long at work, often on weekends, evenings when I'm going to shows or things like that. When I'm in the car, I can't listen to music because I start thinking too much about what the music is. So I can only, weirdly enough, I can listen to podcasts, but I can't listen to music when I'm in the car anymore.
Yeah, it's funny because I'll go for like a day I'll only hear the music that I'll hear if I'm in a coffee shop or if I'm in a store or something like that and they've got it playing.
Mm-hmm.
And I find if I'm more than a day without my iPod or listening to something on the computer or put a CD in the machine, I find I need it.
I think I need it. Like, I think if I didn't write about it, I would listen to it all the time anyways in a very different way.
Yeah.
I also can't write while I'm listening to music that has words.
Mm.
So I can write listening to classical music or Explosions in the Sky or one of the bands that doesn't contain any lyrical content, but I'm so influenced and so enamored with language and lyrics that I can't do that.
So growing up for everyone is pretty tough.
Yeah.
For you, because you talk about what growing up was like for you, one of the things I noticed was that music was really affected your formative years. And I don't know, it underscores one's life,
mm-hmm.
to use that trite phrase. But in your sense, you went back to the music you were listening to and it clarified a lot of things about those early years.
Yeah, I think so. I you grow up and you're surrounded by all the music you listen to, all the music your friends listen to, what is supposed to be popular, and, you're either the weirdo who doesn't like that or you're, falling in line with everybody the way that kids want to. I wasn't super conscientious of the fact that it was changing me at the time, but I've always enjoyed looking back. I've always enjoyed trying to figure out who I was at one point and then reconciling that with who I am now and trying all the time, hopefully, to be like a better, more aware person. And music, I just realized, played so much of a role in that. Like, those four women that I talk about in the book, I realized how they were like these weird fairy godmothers from my life because Sarah, I knew she was really important to me then because she was the basis of a lot of friendships that I had. She was a big part of my life. I talk about it in the book, listening to her when my dad died, which sounds a bit cliche, but that's what the music is there for. It's there to get you through hard times. And Alanis Morissette, I knew at the time that she really freed something in me, you know, like you're a 15-year-old girl in Vancouver. I was, like, attending my first Take Back the Night rallies and things like that, listening to Jagged Little Pill. It was a really heady time. It was really exciting. And I also knew how much I really disliked, vehemently opposed, actually, just even the existence of Shania Twain and Celine Dion. And, going back, actually, and, like, really reframing that for me, that's been the most important part of, like, my growing up as a feminist now. And really thinking about how we inherit very weird, static, regressive views and don't challenge them unless we force ourselves to.
Do you think writing this book has made you grow up a little bit?
Oh, God, yeah. I think it made me really, take a lot of ownership and responsibility for who I used to be and celebrating how people can change. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I mean, it's obviously everyone changes, but I think definitely, and particularly as people have asked me to provide, like, more about me in the book, which my editors, you know, they did. And that was after I handed in the first draft, they asked for more of me in the second draft. And my first reaction was to just cry. Cause I just didn't understand. Like, I don't know if it's cause I'm a journalist and I'm trained to try and take myself out of it. And I've been playing with that form a lot more in the last couple of years and writing much more personal, content. But, you know, my first reaction was to cry, and my husband was like, if the worst thing about your first draft of your book is that they want more of you, you're fine.
Yeah.
Like, suck it up. You can do it. And, and so I did, and I cranked out 25 or 30 pages about me in 18 hours or something, and I had my second draft the next day.
I told you as you walked in here that I wanted more about you in the book, and the person that wrote the review in the National Post, Grace Lisa Scott, said the same. That was one of the weaknesses of the book, was that there wasn't enough of you in it.
Yeah, it blows my mind. I feel like that's kind of like the strange compliment.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that as I work towards becoming more, I don't know, or less self-effacing, perhaps. Mm-hmm. That's my goal. I don't know where that's going to take me. But I feel like I sort of, like, pour out my guts all the time in everything I do, and I don't want to bore people. But if people are responding to that, then that's great. And I'm constantly being reminded that the work that I do that resonates seemingly most deeply with people is stuff that is anchored in my personal experience.
And I guess music is personal, isn't it? I mean, when we put the things in our ears to listen to it, it's obviously a solitary experience. When we listen to it in the subway or something like that, when music's playing on the PA system, we all hear it, but our reactions to it are very personal.
But there's something so intimate about that moment,
yeah,
and sharing that moment with people. And I think this is actually part of why, like, when I go to a show and there's a standing ovation at the end, even if I haven't enjoyed the show, I will physically cry every time, because feeling that emotion of people, like, even if I haven't gotten it, that's fine. It's not about me. Like, all of these people that are enjoying this thing together, and that sort of, it changes the space that you're in. There's so much more potential for life in that moment.
Looking at these four women, McLaughlin, Morissette, Dionne, and Twain, because as I mentioned in the introduction, of the four of them, they're in that top 10 of the best-selling artists in Canada. So that includes U2 and the Beatles as well. And only five of them are Canadian. The other one is Diana Krall. So of the five top-selling artists in Canada who are Canadian, they're all women.
Yeah.
In terms of the business, just taking away for a sec about you and what those four women mean for people listening to music.
Mm-hmm.
Did they change the business? Did they change the industry a great deal?
I feel like they did. I know that they, in part, and from a practical standpoint, they benefited from the fact that CDs were huge in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
So from a very practical standpoint, it was just a really good time and place. But there were a ton of bands at that moment that could have also benefited from those CD sales. So I think those four, or five, if we want to include Diana Krall, I feel that they really, because they represented such different genres, but there was like this tiny little epicenter of overlap, which is that they all happen to be Canadian.
Mm-hmm.
They had a chance to get there first. Shania Twain really brought the sort of country pop to North America in a way that no one had really done it before.
Mm-hmm.
Celine Dion, you know, she had her French audience, and she also had just this huge emotional distance that was, I think, you know, Mariah Carey had a lot going on, Whitney Houston had a lot going on, the Voices sort of similar capacity, but I think Celine Dion, she really does milk every moment for what it's worth, you know, and in forcing people to feel something, I think a lot of people actually really respond to that because we're a culture that like tries not to feel things as much as possible. So Celine Dion gives us this weird permission to, or she just feels the things for us, mm-hmm. so we don't have to. Alanis Morissette, you know, the Riot Girls were, they had had their moment already a little bit, and they were moving into even a broader conversation, but that's why it was ready to go mainstream, because mm-hmm. everyone's cool older brother and sister had listened to that, you know, in the early 90s, and then Alanis Morissette was able to blow that up and make it huge. And she also, you know, there was a lot of things she covered on that record. People always focus on the angry part.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a huge amount of vulnerability and just sort of challenging emotional scarcity. And Sarah McLachlan, you know, she also really, she had such an interesting voice. It was like Tori Amos, but I feel she was a little bit more accessible for people. And so, I don't know, I think all four of them brought something really just interesting and unique and new at the time, and then everyone in America rushed super hard to get the copycats out, because everyone wants to be there first.
So if they weren't around, do you think it would have been harder for a woman to be a superstar in music, say?
You know, I don't know. I mean, I would imagine that they opened a lot of doors, and because, you know, record executives were admitting at the time, we got a copycat, we got to get our own person out here, you know, if we need our own Sarah McLachlan, we need our own Alanis Morissette. So I'm sure that a lot of female artists did get picked up at the time in order to sort of try and replicate that success. As to whether that has then continued to open doors for women over the last 20 years, I think there's like cycles in music where we see that, you know, we're still having conversations about gender equality in music, mm-hmm. and a lack of women on leading the main stages at festivals. The kind of festival that Sarah McLachlan did with Lilith Fair, that, you know, she tried to relaunch it again a few years ago. There was just no climate for it. It's all very weird.
Yeah, look, I was wondering, are there people like these four today in their respective fields and their respective genres?
I think so. I mean, I think, you
but,
know,
but nothing in that scale that these
well,
four...
nothing in the record scales, because record sales are so different for the music industry. But I mean, obviously Taylor Swift, like the big, like some of the biggest names in music right now really are definitely women.
Beyonce,
Nicki Minaj, Taylor Swift, Rihanna, you know, those are Katy Perry.
Yeah.
Those are huge, huge names. Canada, you know, doesn't quite have the sort of solo female artists anymore that like are the as high profile as those women, but we do have still some of the biggest bands in the world. It's like we flip from solo artists to bands for a little while. It may flip back.
Mm-hmm.
There are some really cool women coming out of Canada that are absolutely amazing, and other bands are starting to really gain traction with, you know, female front singers and stuff.
So you've talked about how Sarah McLachlan and Alanis Morissette affected your life. As to Celine Dion and Shania Twain, you didn't like them and you were quite critical of them in those early years. Would you talk about how your views changed and with regards to seeing them as feminists, say?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to make anyone like... I don't know. I don't want to tell anyone that they have to be feminist or not. I hope everyone is. I hope men and women are all over the world. But I think that what I didn't give them credit for, like I bought into the idea that the men that they were with were making them.
The men that they were married to, the music producers.
The music producers. And I really bought into that idea, but it's complete and utter crap. You know, Celine Dion and Shania Twain both have hustled super hard since they were, you know, 8 years old. They were performing all the time, they were singing, they were making money for their families to keep them, you know, out of intense poverty. They worked and hustled from a very young age. Shania Twain co-wrote with her husband all of the songs, and I really feel quite strongly that they each sort of usually did a song that was their own on the records. Shania's songs were always stronger than Mutt's. So for people to say that she was just this puppet of his, I find really galling now, even though I bought into it when I was a teenager. Celine Dion and Renee, I mean, sure, there are like some squicky factors to that whole...
Yeah, they're weird.
That whole relationship.
Yeah.
But obviously they love each other. And obviously, you know, he saw a lot of talent in her, and he spent his whole life championing her. How does he get credit for her talent? That's crazy to me. How is that even possible? You know, it's not like Hillary Clinton has gotten credit for Bill Clinton's talent.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's really about just trying to, I see it so often, but like diminishing women's victories on the basis of not liking them for whatever the reason is.
Yeah.
Not liking them as people, not liking them as role models, not liking their clothes or their outfits, they're too sexy, not sexy enough, blah, 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 blah. Like, it's just, it's so tiring.
Yeah.
And I mean, I'm super grossed out that I participated in it at all, but I really, actually working at CBC was part of what made me really confront that, because, mm-hmm. you know, the mandate is to really support Canadian music as much as possible. And I thought about, like, why did I dislike Celine Dion and Shania Twain? What is that about? And then I really started to examine their legacies and who they were as people. And, I mean, a lot of the sort of the points of record at the time, the people writing about the music at the time, they really do shape the legacies that we sort of read about. Like, when you're visiting a, I don't know, for lack of a better word, like a Wikipedia entry, mm-hmm. or, like, you know, looking back in time to see how they were regarded by critics, no one was very fair to them. And that's the legacy that, you know, is left in terms of the written record of their importance. And so I felt it was kind of important to correct that record.
And one of the more egregious criticisms that Shania Twain got was all the slut-shaming she got.
Oh, because, so much slut-shaming.
Yeah, and so how did you, say, revise your view on that?
Well, I would never, ever, ever, like, I've never believed, even marching at a Take Back the Night rally, there, like, and I did that when I was, like, 15 or 16, I would never look at another woman beside me and be like, oh, well, you're wearing that outfit, you deserve to be raped.
Yeah.
That's ridiculous. That is absolutely ridiculous. And policing women's bodies, policing their outfits, I mean, I remember that was what I was told all the time growing up, like, you know, don't wear that, you don't want to invite trouble. Oh my God, why don't we focus on, maybe telling people that, you know, it's none of your business. Wear whatever you want. It's fine. How about we focus on the whole not raping part?
Yeah.
Women's bodies don't belong to anybody but the women themselves. And this has been, just such a frustrating thing, like, my whole life. And then realizing that I participated in this way that's, like, super gross. I mean, I saw it so much with Miley Cyrus a few years ago, and there are many things that you can criticize about people and about women and pop stars and their roles in the world. Their bodies and what they wear does not have to be one of them.
Yeah. Yeah. In terms of sexism, do you think these four women have done enough to combat it?
I don't think it's our job to combat, or, like, I don't think it's their job to combat sexism. Like,
yeah.
I think... They, like, it's so tiring, you know, to just take on the world's problems, in the same way that it's, you know, it's, I don't feel a personal responsibility, myself,
yeah.
to combat sexism. I want to. I fight back against sexist people all the time, but I don't think it's anyone's job to, like, have to do it. Like, we all get to be responsible for our own actions and try and, like, police each other a little bit in that way. And or just be nice humans in that way. Not even policing each other, because that's, like, that's not a very great turn of phrase, but but just watching out for each other, you know? Like, I don't think it's their job at all. They made their music, they did their thing. They've contributed to the world. It's up to the rest of us to do a bit more.
One of the themes that you work out in this book is friendship,
mm-hmm.
and the friendships that you have had over the years, and some of the friends that you've lost over the years that you've regained, some of the ones that you've made, and as you alluded to earlier, they've all come together, some of them have come together, I should say, through music.
Mm-hmm.
What does one learn about friendship from listening to this music?
Oh, I think so much. I mean, I think that there is real... just empowerment and solidarity a lot of the times. I mean, through these particular artists in general, Sarah McLachlan, I mean, she does have her later work, I think, was more about whatever that personal thing that was going on between her and the possible friend and her ex-husband. Don't know what's happening there.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that's where that was alluded to at some point. But I think in the earlier work, you know, what music does is create sort of the shorthand between people. And friendships are all about the shorthand between people. You don't want to have to explain everything all the time. You're working basically towards some sort of weird twin ESP all the time.
You want to connect with people.
You want to connect with people, and you want people to know you. And, you know, all of their songs, in some capacity, encourage just that closer relationship. I mean, I don't think any of them truly focus that much on friendship or female friendship at all. All four of them really tended towards sort of being more about the romantic relationships. Except I will say Alanis Morissette's Mary Jane, that was a really big focal point for a lot of my friends when we were younger, and just trying to just be there for people without judgment, without criticism, as much as possible, and encouraging you to be like a slightly better friend in whatever that means to you.
Some of the people in your life that you write about in this book, you refer to them as letters rather than their name. Why?
I could have given fake names, I guess. I just didn't really want to use their names without their permission. And I also didn't want to, I mean, I think of it as, have you ever had an apology from someone in AA?
No. Well, I have. Yeah.
And sometimes it's nice, but sometimes you're like, you know what? I did not want to relive that. This was my attitude with this particular project. I was like, I could write some of these people and like, just, you know, be like, hey, heads up.
Yeah.
I'm going to talk about your family. And I chose not to. Other people, though, we were texting during the writing. And I was like, oh, hey, just a heads up. I've given you an initial, and you're in the book, and that's just a heads up.
Yeah.
Like, and she was like, all right, I'm interested to read this. And it was particularly potentially awkward since we've never talked about, like, how we're friends again. Or, like, and, like, the whole split up when we were teenagers. And normally I talk about that stuff with people. Like, I am honest to a fault a lot. I try really hard not to lie to people. But we have never addressed, like, the fact that we stopped speaking in grade 12 and then started talking again when we were, like, 28 or whatever. And it's just easier because, whatever, people change.
It's the shorthand, I think.
It is the shorthand.
You fall out with people and you just pick up where you left off in a way.
Yeah, and, like, we're casual acquaintances now. We're friends.
Mm-hmm.
I think we'll always be those people who, like, love each other in a really, like, meaningful way, but we're not daily friends, and it's cool. And she really loved the book, so that was good.
So a lot of the people that you write about in the book, did they like how they were, say, portrayed?
Oh, I have no idea, you know? So few people have told me. Like, weirdly, like, I mean, my grandma, my dad's mom, she read the book, and she loved it so much, but her attitude, and I'm so close to her.
Yeah.
But, and I guess I do talk about her in the book. Her attitude was, okay, well, this is good, but when are you going to write a real book? She wants me to write fiction. That's a real book to her.
Ah, yes.
My mom has not said anything. I have no idea if she read it. She came to the book launch. She's, you know, she's supportive, etc. And anybody else that's in, I mean, my husband read the book, obviously. He was, like, helping me through it as I was writing it. And my in-laws were very excited that apparently he has long eyelashes that I love. You know, that kind of stuff.
As I said in the earlier, growing up in these years are pretty tough. And so having thought about it now in the course of writing this book, what do you know now that you didn't know before? What's been clarified for you about who you are, especially from where you come from?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I can always be more compassionate. That's one of the things I'm really working on, is just trying to, I mean, I've always been interested in people, observing them, analyzing them. you could say judging them in my head since I'm a writer and that's how I make sense of certain things.
Yeah.
But just trying really hard to be a little bit more compassionate. I would love to write more about growing up in my neighborhood. I think there was it was such an interesting area and there was so much diversity. And I don't see stories like that being told, really, about, like, sort of the true, the true landscape of what Vancouver, yeah. and especially East Vancouver, yeah. really has been, which is, you know, young working families, immigrant families, and everyone together.
Yeah.
You know, there's just something really fascinating. Like, I don't know, maybe one of five white kids in my school.
Mm-hmm.
My reality growing up is not... the sort of Abbotsford, the blinding white of Abbotsford mm-hmm. when I was a kid. It's not anymore, which is great. And just really, like, getting more diversity and multiculturalism out into the world.
Yeah.
I would like to write a lot about that from my standpoint, from growing up.
So we grew up on the same street then, because you grew up on Fraser.
Yeah.
I grew up here at Fraser and King Edward area.
Yeah.
You grew up South Van?
Yeah, Fraser and 45th is where I spent, yeah. like, my teenage years, and Fraser and 54th is my pre-teen years.
Yeah, it's a lot a busier, well, then and now, it's a lot busier place than, say, where I grew up in King Edward, because it was just mainly houses here only in the last 5-10 years.
Yeah, your area was like no man's land on
yeah.
Fraser Street, like,
yeah.
I remember that.
Yeah, there was no stores around, certainly no coffee shops, now there's all kinds of things up and down, like from Kingsway all the way to 33rd.
Yeah.
You ought to write about it because it's changing a great deal.
It's so exciting though, isn't it? Like I love it. I mean, I don't know if I love all of the gentrification necessarily, but I do love the idea that there are, I still see so much diversity in Fraser Street. Like Fraser
yeah.
Street to me is the be all and end all of what it means to be a Vancouverite. And I say that as someone, yes, okay, I grew up here. So I have the nostalgia for it.
Yeah.
But, you know, we grew up on top of, after my parents split up, they sold their house. We didn't have a house anymore. We grew up on top of the drugstore at 45th and Fraser. It's now like a dollar store across from Bilo. And like we lived on top of that.
Oh yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm picturing it in my head. Cause again, that street has changed a great deal.
Yes.
I'm trying to remember it from 10, 15, 20 years ago.
It used to be a drugstore.
Yeah.
I can't remember. The U-Save, maybe, or something.
Something like
that.
Yeah.
Anyway, across from the Bilo.
Yeah.
And, you know, my dad had to walk through our bedroom to get to his bedroom. My grandma slept in the living room. Like, you know, close quarters. But it was a great home. It was such a good home. And
yeah.
it was such a nice place to live. And, you know, going from Henderson to John Oliver and... I don't know, all that stuff. I really have such affection for Fraser Street, and I really think it deserves to be the setting of, like, a TV show or a book or something.
Yeah. Yeah, it has changed a great deal, and as you said, I mean, in reading the book, one felt nostalgic for a lot of, you know, what's changed, because it has changed a great deal. I mean, I've lived in this house now for 22 years or so.
Oh, wow.
And the people around have changed.
Of course.
I mean, the immigrants have come in from different countries than that were once here.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, younger families have moved in with kids. I guess as the line between East and West changes and goes further east now.
Yeah.
It's become odd. It's... You know, it's
definitely sort of a hip area to live in now, which I'm sure makes a lot of people on Fraser Street just like go like, what is that even?
Yeah.
I don't even get it. I am really like pleased to see how basically you still hit 43rd and it's still such an interesting, weird little neighborhood between 43rd and 49th.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's still a lot of the old, markets and
mm-hmm.
things like that mixed with, I don't know, the
banks.
Liquor store and the bank.
Yeah.
And do you remember the theater that used to be there, the movie theater?
Where?
There was a movie theater at the Van City at 46th.
Oh, okay, yeah, okay. No, I don't.
Oh, it was great. That was like one of the first places I ever saw a movie.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh. Huh.
Yeah.
Because people say that there used to be a movie theater at Fraser and Kingsway, but that's like way, way, that's like in
oh,
the
yeah,
50s.
Yeah.
In the, like,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know.
That's still technically there. They just haven't, because it was like the Raja, and then it was going to be the Collingwood Cinema.
Yeah.
And then the I don't know, financing didn't work out or whatever. Anyway. Yeah.
So will you, I mean, because not to patronize you, as I said, it is such a good book. Will you continue to write?
Oh, yeah.
And about yourself, because about that's myself. What we all want, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I guess if the demand's there, that's really cool. I would like to. I think, I think there's a lot of things that I really do want to write about. I want to write more about my family and more about growing up and all the different families that I knew growing up and things like that. I would also really enjoy writing fiction. Mm-hmm. So, you know, maybe some loosely fictionalized growing up stuff that could work out too. So definitely other things that I'd like to do for sure. And I mean, I kept my writing job all through writing this book. I just do the 24-hour hustle all the time. Mm-hmm. So I'm still writing all the time.
Because when I talk to authors, whether they're memoirs or fiction, they like to say that it's after completing the book that it's a catharsis for them, for something so personal.
Mm-hmm.
Did you find that it left you a different person?
Yeah, I think I was a bit empty on the other side of it for a little while. You know, I mean, the huge highs of writing it and talking about it afterwards, and people being excited about it. Like, we're in our second printings, and that's kind of a deep thrill for me. I mean, it was a small print run. It's a small press. I would like to see it in, like, selfishly, I would really like to see it in, like, university, like, reading lists and stuff. Just so, because when you're at university, most of the people you're writing about are just, like, white dudes and reading about white dudes. And, I mean, you know, I mean, I understand this is white women. We could read about way more diverse people. Totally get it. But just some
Let's
women.
Start there.
Start with some women, you know? So I would like to see that happen. But it definitely, July and August of this summer, because the book came out in late April.
Yeah.
July and August were a bit of a retreat inwards. Didn't really want to go out. Didn't really want to talk to anybody that much. Kind of just laid low as much as possible. And now I feel a little bit more myself.
So what do you think? Because you poured yourself out, that it left you empty, or did you think you've worked out, say, problems that you had, and you were looking for other problems?
Nothing,
to have.
Nothing left to write now. No, God, I don't think I worked out all my problems. I luckily have so many problems.
We all
so,
do. Yeah.
Yeah, it's totally fine. No, I think I just gave a lot. I went really hard for a really long time, and you know, a lot of people, I'm sure, do write books in the evening outside of their day jobs.
Mm-hmm.
I'm by no means special in that capacity, but I also write all day long for a living, and so that was like I think a little bit taxing, and particularly since I do write about music all day long for a living as well. Also during the middle of all this. Just as I was about a month away from handing in the first draft, I got laid off, and then I was supposed to be laid off, and then I wasn't laid off. I don't know. It's a whole thing. And I think it was just like a sort of emotional thing after emotional thing. It was just really, I just needed 6 weeks to sort of opt out of life as much as I could while still working every day and still keeping up with my family.
Well, I'm sure younger people come up to you and ask you about writing, because a lot of people think they can do it and would like to do it as a career, and then they look to you as someone who is, and perhaps seek advice, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
What do you tell them about? I mean, it is a lot of hard work.
Yeah, I think it's a lot of hard work, and I think you also have to you have to really enjoy writing.
Yeah,
that's the thing. Like, you know, when we look at sort of Celine and Shania and Sarah and all those people. They wanted it from the day one. They were willing to work for it, and they just worked really hard at it. And there's like such tenacity. Like, I don't even have the tenacity of those women, and that's I'm still writing all the time. So I think the most important part is to like write all the time, and then figure out sort of what you want from it. Because like, I mean, it's not just like you can write something and then leave it. Like, you have to keep polishing it, keep editing it, keep working at it. And I think a lot of people think that it just comes out and it's going good to go. And that's, like, really not the case at all. Like, I mean, it's, I'm a fairly self-critical writer, so I edit while I write a little bit. And, but I also know that, you know, especially, like, when I was writing poetry when I was a teenager, I would rewrite that poem, like, 400 times. Just because there's always a little something you can do to it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm grateful for deadlines because I'm also a procrastinator.
Mm.
But I love meeting deadlines. I'm obsessed with time. So I try to combine all those things and just meet your deadline, write every day, and treat it like anything else that you always want to get better at.
Have you met any of these four women?
No, I've interviewed Sarah McLachlan, but I haven't met any of them.
You interview in person or?
Over the phone.
Over the phone. I saw her once in a room. It was at the Juno Awards. I was in the press room.
Mm-hmm.
And she came in and she answered a few questions. And then one naughty journalist asked her to sing something. And so she did. She sang a line or two of a song.
Wow.
And it was unbelievable because you know how press rooms are, especially at award shows. They're hectic and the sort.
Especially at the Junos, yeah.
Yeah, and the room just stopped. And even when she was just talking to the people in the room, there's just something luminous about her.
Yeah, I think she has a very commanding presence. And I mean, you see that actually a lot in when you're, you know, I don't know how often you go out to see new bands, but, you know, there are a lot of bands. Not all of them are going to make it. That's just the way it is. But every once in a while, one of them has, like, a person in the band who just is captivating.
Yeah.
And it's not about a sexual attraction because everyone's attracted to something different. But there's just something incredibly captivating about a person. They have excellent stage presence. It's something you can't really teach that well.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, you can do hard work and be proficient and excellent at your job or whatever. But there really is something very special about certain performers. And I think we see that in how the public responds to them and how they become superstars.
And each of these four women have a certain charisma about them that you can't really... I mean, you can copy it, but it's not the same, and you can't teach it. It's just there.
I agree. And I went through this phase a few weeks ago where I was looking at old YouTube videos of superstars before they were famous.
Yeah.
And you can see, like, Beyonce has been hustling since she was, like, 3 years old. Like, beauty pageants and singing competitions and on and on and on. And she just has always had something really special about her. You know, Shania Twain had it too. Celine had it too. Like, there was just all of them, really.
So if given the chance to talk to them after having written this book, what would you tell them?
Well, I try not to make people feel awkward. Uh-huh. So I might not even like say much about the book at all. Like if it was just an assignment for something else and it had nothing to do with the book, I might not even bring it up. Because I'm there to do my job and, you know, get their stories out, not further foster my own. You know, I try really hard not to be all ego gratification all the time. So, yeah, that would... But if they knew about the book and it was, like, set up as a place to talk about the book, then I would talk to them just about, like, you know, the kinds of things that I have perceived about their careers and ask them for their perceptions, because I'm really only telling my view of their lives in this. And I love giving people a chance to tell their own stories with their own words.
Well, it's a wonderful book, as I said when you walked in here. I really enjoyed it. I hope it continues to do well. And congratulations on it. And thanks so much for coming in. It's a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you so much. This has been a really wonderful interview.
Thank you. The website for more, theandreawarner.com. The book is called We Oughta Know, How Four Women Ruled the 90s and Changed Canadian Music. Eternal Cavalier is its publisher. Do pick it up. You'll learn a great deal about just how important these women are in the discourse in this culture and in this country. And you'll learn a bit about Ms. Warner's life, which is altogether quite interesting. Andrea Warner joined me in person here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.